Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.
LA Supervisors and Latino Voting Rights. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is Which Way LA, KCIW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. The hearing room at LA County's Hall of Administration is generally almost empty while five supervisors conduct public business. Last night was different. With more than 800 people signed up to speak, additional rooms were needed to accommodate the audience. The supervisors rejected a move to redraw their district boundaries so a second Latino might have a better chance to be elected. Tonight we'll hear about voting by race, color blindness, and the careers of elected officials. Later on, Chris Christie, the man who didn't say no. First, here's the news. We're on only back with Which Way LA on KCRW. Most Americans haven't heard much about New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, but with Rick Perry becoming a joke for late-night comedians, Christie's being touted by influential Republicans and financial backers as the latest instant white knight candidate for president. Later on, we'll hear how Christie, despite his denials, is keeping the prospect alive. First, after a long and sometimes passionate hearing last night, LA County supervisors rejected a move to radically redraw their district boundaries by a vote of 4-1. Gloria Molina and Mark Ridley Thomas wanted to create a new Latino majority district by drastically changing districts now held by Zev Yaroslavsky and Don Kanabi, respectively. Yaroslavsky and Kanabi opposed both plans along with Mike Antonovich, but four votes were needed, and Mark Ridley Thomas finally joined them to produce a majority for a plan by Kanabi. It pretty much maintains the status quo. We'll hear from both Kanabi and Ridley Thomas in just a moment. First, here's Gene Mattis, who covered the hearing for the LA Weekly. Gene, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
Describe the scene down there with almost 1,000 people wanting to testify.
It was quite a scene. There were, I think, more than 800 people who signed up to testify. You had every racial group in Los Angeles represented there. You had Latinos and whites and blacks and Asians and Tongans and Native Americans. Everybody came out for this. And, you know, if you had to pick one public hearing to learn the most you could about Los Angeles, this would probably be the one. And they were all sort of debating about whether the dominant thing about living in Los Angeles is that, you know, we're all divided up into separate racial and ethnic enclaves, or whether the dominant fact is that, you know, despite that, we can reach across those enclaves and share common interests and concerns. So it was quite a lively and spirited, as you might imagine, debate through the whole day.
This all comes about, of course, because there has to be a reapportionment of the districts based on the U.S. Census every 10 years, as we've heard already in terms of the state. Now the county is doing it, but the supervisors themselves have to vote on these districts.
Yeah, they do. And, you know, that seems like, I mean, the outcome you described seems like it was pretty much foreordained. You know, if you are asking the incumbent members of a body to draw their own districts, they're probably going to draw them in a way that protects themselves and that preserves the status quo. And, in fact, that is what happened. So I don't think that was terribly surprising that it came out that way.
Was the argument made, particularly with regard to Latinos, that their population has grown sufficiently in the past 10 years or 20 years? Molina's district was created 20 years ago, that a new district is now justified. Was that the argument?
Yeah, essentially, you know, it has a couple of elements to it. One, the argument is that you can draw maps in a way where there are two districts that have majority Latino populations and that can elect Latino members. And that because there is racially polarized voting, is the term for it, in Los Angeles County, you have to draw those maps. In other words, under the Voting Rights Act, if you have Latinos voting for Latinos and non-Latinos voting against Latinos, then you have to draw maps in a way where Latinos are given the power to vote for their own representatives.
That's according to the Voting Rights Act of the United States.
Yes, U.S. Voting Rights Act.
Okay. So were there people there who normally would support the Voting Rights Act and that kind of thing, arguing against making the kinds of changes that were proposed?
Well, I mean, it was interesting. I mean, Gloria Molina is the person making the strongest argument for adding a Latino seat, but that doesn't mean every Latino agrees with her. So, Don Kanabe and Xavier Oslovsky had Latino constituents come out and say, you know what, we like our districts the way they are. We're Latino, but we also feel like Don Kanabe does a good job for us. We feel like Xavier Oslovsky does a good job for us, and so we want to maintain the current boundaries. So, I mean, it's not like all the whites are on one side of this debate and all the Latinos are on the other side of this debate. It's much more complex and fluid than that.
But there were West Side liberals, I gather, who were there, who you might expect under other circumstances to be in favor of something under the Voting Rights Act, who were arguing that they didn't want their district changed.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Redistricting is sort of a boring subject in one way, but in another way, it kind of takes in every single issue that the county could ever consider, because who represents you is pretty fundamentally important, no matter what your issue is. So if it's development, you might be pretty interested in having Xavier Oslovsky being your representative if you don't want to see a condo developed next to your house. So there's a lot of issues that get dragged into this as well. So it's hard to predict exactly where people are going to line up.
Gene Mattis, once again, staff writer for the LA Weekly. Let's go to the supervisors. Mark Ridley Thomas, LA County Supervisor, representing the 2nd District, Culver City, Carson, Beverlywood, and other neighborhoods. All these districts are huge. Supervisor, good to have you back on our program.
Delighted to be here, Warren.
Why were you in favor initially of a new Latino district?
Well, I think it's consistent with the spirit and the intent of the Voting Rights Act to maximize political empowerment for those who have been traditionally and systematically denied such. It is not a stretch of the imagination, given my history and background as a leader in the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, which led the effort in 1965 across that Edmund Pettus Bridge to argue for the fulfillment of the promises of democracy. And so that's applicable here and now. Today, it's a fact that the state of California is under the sanction of the Voting Rights Act still, owing to bilingual balance and a whole range of other things. And so my view, in solidarity with those views expressed by Supervisor Molina, was to make sure that we are in compliance with the Voting Rights Act. Therefore, we produced two distinct maps. And it's interesting to note that it was African-American religious leaders as well as social service leaders and community leaders who brought forward the map that I then introduced, known as S2. And I maintained the point of view that this was an important thing to do, and ultimately, as we now know, the courts will more than likely have to determine whether or not what the board did last night is in compliance with the Voting Rights Act.
Okay, I'll come back to you in a moment and ask about your change of vote. First, here's Don Kanabe. He has District 4, runs from Long Beach to Marina Del Rey and out to Diamond Bar, once again an enormous area. And Don Kanabe, good to have you on our program.
Nice to be on the program, Warren.
Why were you opposed to the district that Mark Ridley Thomas was advocating, as well as the one that Gloria Molina was advocating?
Well, I think one of the most significant issues is what we tried to do with the map. Our first responsibility was to make it compliant with the Voting Rights Act. And we did that in a number of different ways by changing minimal boundaries, adding increased Latino representation in my district, reducing some in other areas. We changed out Westchester between Mark and I and other minor things. We moved about 230,000 people. And we were told by outside counsel and the evaluation and all the census tracts and doing all the numbers that we were well within Voting Rights Act complicity. And so with that, we maintained the community's interest. And as was mentioned, as Gene mentioned so well, this crossed racial barriers. I mean, this, at the end of the day, we are the safety net for the people of Los Angeles County. We don't get to talk about wars and all the other things. We are where the rubber meets the road. We have to fix the problem. So when you come to a county clinic, you don't ask if you're black, white, yellow, you know, whatever color, or a Republican, Democrat, or Libertarian. We have to solve the problems. And so what we maintained was trying to, number one, keep communities of interest together. Number two, the
How do you
rights.
Define a community of interest? What do you mean by that, as opposed to a racial similarity?
Communities of interest could be a number of cities getting together. It could be for regional transportation. It could be health care. It could be community clinics. It could be a number of areas where we all now realize it's sort of regionalized in areas, not necessarily isolated to one community or another. Because once we dealt with the issue of Voting Rights Act, the next issue was to see how we could keep these communities of interest together, and that's what we worked. Like I said, we moved about 230,000 people in the map we presented. The other two maps moved over 3 million people, 3 million people each, which is a very significant disruption to the kinds of issues that we have to deal with as a county. And so we met our obligation. There are those, I mean, the interpretations are different, and as Mark indicated, it may eventually wind up in a court, but there are those that said because of these population changes, you do have to create a district, a second Latino district. It wasn't just creating a second Latino district. If you look at Mark's district, you look at my district, it's very competitive for a potential Latino. They wanted control, and the Voting Rights Act is very clear that you don't have to create control at the expense of every other ethnic group in the county of Los Angeles. What the plans that were presented had a significant impact. As an example, and Gene was there, the Asian Pacific Islander communities were definitely impacted by the other two maps. So we have a balancing act. It was democracy in action. You know, over 1,000 people. Every time, our three hearings were absolutely packed in that hearing room. One particular group that came down in support of me said it was probably one of the best civic engagement lessons they've ever had about relationships, character, core values, and integrity really being more important than race to some of the folks. Each of us had strong Latino support. Each of us had Asian Islander support. So, I mean, we crossed the barriers, and I think the testimony reflected that, and that's why eventually we were successful with the plan that we presented.
Don Canabi, I'll come back to you as well, but first let me introduce Tom Sines. He is President and General Counsel for the Mexican American Legal Defense and Education Fund, that's MALDEF, Latino Civil Rights Organization. Tom Sines, good to have you on our program.
Good to talk to you, Warren.
It's been indicated, or you've indicated, I don't know if you've made a final announcement as yet, that the plan that the board approved yesterday is not good enough from your standpoint, and that's why both the supervisors we have heard from say this may end up in court.
I think it's highly likely that this will end up in court. I think that the district lines that were adopted by the supervisors do not comply with the Federal Voting Rights Act, which I think you've fairly defined the obligation there. It does dictate the creation of a second Latino majority district, and by failing to do that, the supervisors have subjected the county to a significant likelihood of litigation.
What about what Don Canabi just said, that you wanted control and that would come at the expense of other groups? He suggested that the Voting Rights Act doesn't require that it be a majority, or that there some sort of guarantee that a Latino is going to be elected.
Well, in fact, that is what the Voting Rights Act dictates. It says that if you can create a majority-minority district, which you clearly can with today's population figures, and there is racially polarized voting such that that minority group is generally outvoted by the non-Latino population that supports other candidates, then you have to create that district. But more importantly, I think it's important to recognize that preserving the status quo, which is basically what the supervisors did yesterday, means that one ethnic group, white voters, are in control and will remain in control of three of the five supervisorial districts. That is out of proportion with their population in the county today in 2011.
White voters will be in control because they necessarily will elect white supervisors? Is that what you're saying?
This is not about the race of candidates. It's about the voters whose preferences tend to control the outcome of elections.
Okay.
And that's what occurs in three of the five districts, and under the plan that preserves the status quo, would continue to be the case over the next decade.
In 1990, the new supervisorial district for Gloria was created that Gloria Molina won the next year as a result of a lawsuit brought by your organization, the MALDEF. In 2000, the boundaries were pretty much just reaffirmed. Since 2000, and there was no complaint, as I recall. Since then, since 2000, the Latino population in the county, this is according to Xavier Oslovsky's office, has only increased by 3%, from 44% to 47%. Why wasn't the redistricting challenged, or wasn't there this issue brought up in 2000, 10 years ago?
First, let's be accurate. Latinos are now 48% of the population, according to the 2010 census. But based on what we know about the growth of the population, sitting and talking 1 year later, it's likely higher than that. But the reason is that 10 years ago, you could not create a second Latino majority district. The numbers were not there to construct, compliant with the Voting Rights Act, a district where Latino voters would be able to select a supervisor of choice. That's the basic difference.
So that means then that people have moved around?
That means that the increase in the population, the increase in citizenship in some cases, the increase in the voting age population, because the measure of whether a district is Latino majority is based on the citizen voting age population, not the general population. But based on all of those changes and the fact that folks may have moved around, you are now able to construct a compact second majority district.
Okay. Tom Sains, again, President General Counsel for MALDEF, suggesting this probably will end up in court. Mark Ridley Thomas, back to you. Why did you change your vote? Initially, you wanted a Latino district. It requires four votes, and you changed. How come?
Well, simply stated, I believe that we've had enough in the way of public hearings. Supervisor Kanabe indicated in three distinct instances we had a full House, full hearing. No one can really allege that they weren't afforded an opportunity to be heard. We stayed until the last speaker had his or her say. And my view is simply this. Rather than experiment with moving to what is essentially an untested scenario of having the three countywide office holders, the sheriff, the district attorney, and the assessor make the decision. I'm not into the politics of abdication. We can make our own decision. There was a sense that that was the will of the body. Therefore, I made the determination to vote, to move on with this process, with the full realization that the likelihood did exist that we would have this settled in court. Warren, it's my view that it's best to have the court decide rather than to toss it into another precarious partisan political environment.
Okay. Let me just explain to our listeners that under the law in the county, if you hadn't gotten four votes for a plan, then it would go to the group you suggested, Sheriff Lee Baca, District Attorney Cooley, and the assessor to make the decision. That's never happened before, and you didn't want to see try it this time.
And nor did anyone else really wish to see that happen. And let me just conclude by saying the following. When there is no compromise, it probably is best to let the courts decide. And it was very difficult to get a compromise map embraced by the requisite number of members of the board to move forward.
All right. Let me go back to Don Kanabe, also supervisor, whose plan ultimately was approved. What do you say to what Tom Sains just said, that now whites will be in control of three of the five districts, and that's not fair to Latinos, given their makeup of the population?
Well, I mean, that's the major disagreement. That's clearly not the case. And the issue has been, over the last 20 years, the voter polarization has not really transpired in Los Angeles County. From Obama to Mayor Villaraigosa to three of our countywide elected officials being of Latino, in my own district, and the Latino assemblyman, Jenny Oropeza, may she rest in peace, on the west side. They're very, very competitive races. And we were told by outside counsel, one, that the plan that I submitted was voting rights compliant, and two, that we had the ability, that our obligation was to be competitive and not to be put us in a control situation at the expense of every other ethnic group in Los Angeles County.
So, Tom Sines, back to you. How do you respond to that, and what about the other ethnic groups involved?
Well, these are large districts, as you've already indicated, Warren. And it certainly is true that every one of these districts, because they are so large, incorporates portions of each population. But the question really is, based on expert analysis, which voter group determines the outcome in a district? And it is clear that white voters determine the outcome in three of these districts. Now, with respect to the assertion that racially polarized voting doesn't occur in L.A. County in the last 20 years, that's simply proven false by the record. Now, you can't tell racially polarized voting simply by looking at results. You've got to have expert analysis done. Just this year, the statewide redistricting commission had that analysis done in L.A. County, and they and their council advised them that racially polarized voting was still quite significant in Los Angeles County and should therefore dictate what that statewide redistricting commission did with respect to legislative and congressional seats in Los Angeles County.
So this is one of the things you're going to be arguing in court.
Yes, and I've yet to see any expert analysis from the other side that demonstrates in the last 10 years racially polarized voting has not occurred. The only expert analysis that's been made public came from the statewide commission, and it drew a clear conclusion. Racially polarized voting is still significant and of legally significant concern in Los Angeles County.
Okay. Obviously, this will be litigated, or it appears it will be litigated. Don Kanabe has one view. Tom Sines, another. Mark Ridley-Thomas as well. We have one more guest I'd like to get in. Xavier Oslofsky's district would have been very drastically changed had Gloria Molina's plan taken effect. We asked Mr. Jaroslawski to come on our program. He declined our invitation. We do have Richard Close, who's attorney and who's an attorney and president of the Sherman Oaks Homeowners Association. He was on the Los Angeles City Redistricting Commission in 2001. Now, Richard Close, good to have you back on our program today.
Thank you.
What would the Molina plan have done to the Jaroslawski district? And what about Mr. Sines' concerns about the Voting Rights Act?
Well, number one, your program is, I don't think, is called Court Radio. All these arguments will be heard by court. I don't think elected officials need to make decisions because of threats of lawsuits. As long as they have a legal basis for making a decision, they should make a decision and let the courts decide. Number two, what the plans would have done is change who we elected. San Fernando Valley, for the most part, elected Xavier Oslofsky as our supervisor. The change would have meant that many of us, including myself, would have been represented by Supervisor Kanabe, who's a great supervisor, but I didn't elect him. People in the San Fernando Valley didn't elect him. There was no reason for taking away the vote of the people who elected the various supervisors. This is an effort to force a result that is not required by law, and the overwhelming majority of the people that spoke against this mix-up of all the districts in order to accomplish a goal. The goal, I understand, is legitimate, but it's not required by law. And the Board of Supervisors did the right thing. They made adjustments as necessary. They had a commission that worked on this for months and came up with Plan A3. They adopted it. They did the right thing. And if Moldoff wants to go to court, that's their right. They should go to court if they think it's wrong. But that's not an argument for adopting a plan that would affect so many residents, millions of residents throughout the county.
Xavier Oslofsky, whom you elected, is termed out, so you're going to get a new supervisor anyway very soon.
In 3 years. But and it'll be hopefully someone that lives in the San Fernando Valley or the West Los Angeles, a compact district. The proposed district would have had Sherman Oaks and Cerritos in the same district. That doesn't make sense. I understand why Tom has a result he wants to accomplish, but he shouldn't force the 8 million people in Los Angeles County to have a result that they don't want.
I'm sorry we're running short of time. Tom Sines, a quick response if you can.
Yeah, I think this is a natural result of redistricting. There are always voters who are shifted from one district to another. The argument that somehow it's legally of concern that you not move people from district to district is just an argument for keeping in place the status quo. Had we kept to that 20 years ago, there would never have been the first Latino majority district. That's simply not a legal requirement. The Voting Rights Act overrides it.
That's all the time we have. I want to thank all of you very much for being with us. And Richard Closer, you got so short a time. Tom Sines, again, is president and general counsel of the Mexican-American Legal Defense Fund. Richard Close is the president of the Sherman Oaks Homeowners Association. Mark Ridley Thomas and Don Canavi are county supervisors. And Gene Mattis is a staff writer with the L.A. Weekly. Thanks again to all of you for being on our show today.
Thank you, Warren.
Thank you, Warren.
You can join the conversation on our Which Way L.A. Facebook page in a moment. Chris Christie, the man who didn't say no on Which Way L.A. Warren Olney back with Which Way L.A. Last night at the Reagan Library in Simi Valley, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie talked about America's greatness. He disparaged both President Obama and Congress and then got another chance to take himself out of the Republican race for president.
I mean this with all my heart. We can't wait another 4 years. To 2016. We need you. Your country needs you to run for president.
Anybody who has an ego large enough to say, oh, please, please, please stop asking me to be leader of the free world. It's such a burden. If you could please just stop. My answer to you is just this. I thank you for what you're saying. And I take it in, and I'm listening to every word of it and feeling it, too.
Chris Cizilla is Washington Post White House reporter. He also writes the Fix blog at WashingtonPost.com. Chris, always good to have you on our program.
Warren, always good to be with you.
Here's a man who said he might have to commit suicide at some point in order to persuade people that he wasn't running for president. What do you make of what he said last night?
Well, what I think is that he knew he was going to get that question. He purposely did not say anything like, I'm flattered, but I'm not running. Which does not mean, of course, Warren, that he is running, but it also doesn't mean he's not. It means he is, for whatever reason, and his reasons are his own, he's keeping the prospect open that he could rethink it. Now, I don't think he will. I think he probably will wind up staying out. But he knew the answer he could have given to that question that would have ended speculation again, and he chose not to give it. And like I said, his reasons are his own, but in not giving that answer, he ensured people like you and I would be talking about it.
And there he was at the Republican Political Shrine, the Reagan Library in
right.
Simi Valley in California. So of all the places he might have done that, he was in the right one.
Absolutely. And, you know, he's in California today. He's going to be in Louisiana tomorrow raising money for the New Jersey State Party. So he's certainly doing and giving the kind of speeches that you might the activities you might do and the speeches you might give if you were thinking about running for president. It is late in the game, but given kind of the clamor for him, he is someone who obviously have a big impact on the field. And, you know, what I continue to come back to with Chris Christie is two facts. One, he probably enters the race as a front runner in polling if he did get in. And two, he faces a very difficult re-election race in 2013 in a Democratic-leaning state where victory is far from assured. So those two factors to me suggest that he probably should think about it. Doesn't mean he will, but should rethink it. And maybe that's the same thing he's going through right now.
Why would he enter the race as the front runner?
Because the party is clearly clamoring for someone or something else. We saw that with Rick Perry. Rick Perry got in on August 13th and immediately became the front runner in polling, simply because I think there's a sentiment that there's a section of the Republican Party that does not want Mitt Romney to be the nominee and is searching for someone who can reach those Tea Party Republicans, but also court establishment types. Everyone thought that was Perry. It still might wind up being Perry. But there's doubt raised after his performance last week in that, particularly in the second half of that debate in Orlando, where he really struggled. And the question is, does Christie now come in as that figure? Now, maybe he doesn't. And I would think Perry's struggles as a candidate suggest that this is not as easy as it might look from the outside. So, you never know what you're getting yourself into. But I certainly think the level of interest, both from Republicans as well as the media, in Christie would put him, if not at the top, certainly in the top tier of candidates.
Of course, wouldn't he be in the same position as the others have been? We've had one front runner after another, starting with Michelle Bachmann, and all of a sudden they get into the fishbowl of Republican politics with the media following them around and reporting every word. Things turn out a little differently, as they have for Rick Perry.
Absolutely no question. I always compare it to college athletics. When you're recruiting someone, the coach is nice to you and everyone's great to you, and then when you actually join the team, you're just another person on the team. And, you know, so the treatment you get is different, and I think that's probably something that Chris Christie and his folks are at least thinking about too. Is, yeah, everyone loves us right now, but if and when we get into this race, or even if and when we think about rethinking getting into the race, how much does that change, and what does that change mean? And my guess is that's what they're puzzling through right now.
Bridget Harrison is a political science professor at Montclair State University in New Jersey. Professor, good to have you on our program.
Good to be here, Warren.
You said very recently that this speech at the Reagan Library in Simi Valley in California was a do-or-die moment for Chris Christie. He didn't, but he didn't die either.
It's true. He really I think, continues to exceed expectations when it comes to fomenting a buzz about his potential candidacy. And I think partly that is because he recognizes exactly the phenomenon that Chris was just talking about, and that is, if he were to choose to enter, he then becomes subject to a much wider birth of scrutiny and a lot more in-depth analysis, not just of his policies, but also his personality and other facets of his life.
Do you think it's still possible that he might announce as a presidential candidate, given all the reasons we heard from Chris Saliza, including a tough state run in the state, potentially for re-election in 2013?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that he has succeeded in alienating many of the more moderate voters who swung to him in our gubernatorial election. He is, of course, extremely popular among Republicans here in the state, as we heard also throughout the country. But, I mean, my thinking goes along with what Chris is saying, and that is, we don't know the shelf life of Chris Christie's brand of politics. He has proven enormously popular, but the fact of the matter is that his personality in poll after poll indicates that it is kind of wearing, and that people then start to characterize him as a bully. There's an enormous gender gap in the state. And what I think is that he recognizes that not only are his own reelection chances perhaps in doubt here in the state of New Jersey, but also that he may not be a contender in 2016. He'll no longer be the new kid on the block. He'll have had all that time to alienate voters with his policy positions and his personality. And so it may just very well be that he is thinking, perhaps it is now, perhaps 2012 is the year. The other thing, of course, is that we're speculating about 2016. The reality is there could be a Republican president in office in 2016.
Okay. Bridget Harrison, political science professor, Montclair State University in New Jersey. Jonathan Tobin is senior online editor and principal political blogger at Commentary Magazine. Good to have you on our program.
Great. Thanks for having me.
You've done an article that's headlined The Christie Delusion. What does that mean?
Well, I think it's about the need among some Republicans for a savior, someone to come in and save them from having to support Mitt Romney or somebody else. So we've been seeing this really through the spring and the summer, and now into the fall, this chasing after people who clearly aren't going to run. First, it was Mitch Daniels, the governor of Indiana, who seemed like a very plausible candidate, but who turned them down after a lot of buzz that made it seem as if it was almost certain he was going to. The next one was Congressman Paul Ryan, the author of the Medicare Reform Plan, a very important congressman and certainly a bright, attractive leader of the Republicans, who seemed also, at least to Republicans and sort of centrist conservatives, a very plausible candidate. And there was never any doubt. He kept telling them all along it's not going to happen. And finally, you know, after the 15th denial, they gave up. Then there's the third, and in some ways the most implausible of the possible candidates, is Chris Christie. there are a lot of reasons why Chris Christie is not going to run. I should say, I've been saying it all along, and then it appeared in the last week or so that he did reconsider his decision. I don't want to deny that he certainly went back again. But
and he didn't deny it last night.
He didn't, although I have to tell you that some of my sources have told me that earlier yesterday, before the Reagan speech, which he had promised beforehand he wouldn't say one way or the other whether he was going to run, that earlier that day he did tell some of the people who had been importuning him to run that it's not going to happen.
And apparently he told his brother that, or his brother's saying that anyway.
Well, I don't know. I can't speak to the story that was run, I think, on Fox News and National Review. I think it was Fox News, on about his brother. I can't speak to that, but I do believe he's told other people.
Okay, then why won't he run? What's wrong with him as a candidate right now in this particular election coming up?
Well, I should say, first of all, that there's a lot that's right with him. He gave last night was a great example. He gave a great speech. He can be very charming. And he really speaks to the, to the Republican longing for a conservative who can appeal to centrists. That said, and he's a YouTube star, but some of the reasons why he's a YouTube star are the same reasons why he might not, had he run, if he were to run, it's still possible, why that wouldn't work. Because, your typical, Chris Christie YouTube video that has gotten, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of hits, shows Chris Christie being asked a somewhat reasonable question, a pointed question from a voter or a teacher. And rather than acting in the way a normal politician would, which is to be as conciliatory as possible, even if he's sticking to his position, Chris Christie tells the questioner to go jump in a lake.
Mm.
And on YouTube, and certainly to the people who agree with him about the great issues of taxes and spending and unions, it's incredible. Here's a guy who's telling the other side to go jump in a lake. Except that doesn't really play as well. And as much as I'll admit I kind of like it too, but it won't really play as well on the campaign trail where everything you say is examined and twisted and put in a different context. And, that also goes to another thing about his personality as we've seen it as in his 2 years as governor. Republicans like to talk about how thin-skinned Barack Obama is. Well, I don't think he's got anything on Chris Christie, who is very tough with anybody who, says a discouraging word about him. Just ask the candidates who are in how well that goes.
What about his position on issues?
The idea that he's going to fill some slot that is not being filled is the real delusion. In that Chris Christie is a Northeast governor. He is, by conservative Republican standards on issues like immigration, which has gotten Rick Perry into so much trouble lately, he is a moderate. He's not a conservative. He doesn't come in and take votes away, I believe, from Rick Perry or Michelle Bachmann or Herman Cain or any of the unlikely Republican contenders. He's competition for Mitt Romney. If on the day when Chris Christie puts us all out of our misery and says he's not going to run, which I believe he will eventually have to, the person who will be the happiest will be Mitt Romney, because Christie is direct competition for him. So it doesn't work as a mathematical equation. I mean, granted, there doesn't seem to be a strong conservative candidate in it right now, especially since Perry is crashing and burning, at least for the moment. But there's no room in Chris. I don't necessarily see that there's a great path to the nomination for him.
Okay. Jonathan Tobin, again, a senior online editor, principal political blogger at Commentary Magazine. Still with us, Bridget Harrison in New Jersey. Now let's hear a bit about what we have been hearing from all of our previous guests, and that is one of the important reasons why so many Republicans are looking for a new prospective presidential nominee. Here's Rick Perry in last week's presidential debate.
I think Americans just don't know sometimes which Mitt Romney they're dealing with. Is it the Mitt Romney that was on the side of against the Second Amendment before he was for the Second Amendment? Was it before these social programs from the standpoint of he was for standing up for Roe versus Wade before he was against Roe versus Wade? He was for race to the top. He's for Obamacare, and now he's against it. I mean, we'll wait until tomorrow and see which Mitt Romney we're really talking to tonight.
Rick Perry, in one of the episodes that many people are referring to use Jonathan Tobin's phrase, as the crashing and burning of his campaign. Wayne Slater is senior political writer with the Dallas Morning News. Spent a lot of time with Rick Perry and has covered him for a long time. As always, Wayne Slater, good to have you on our program.
Great to be with you, Warren, as always.
How is the Perry campaign dealing with what we just heard and also some other gaffes that took place, so much so that people in the party are referring to his campaign as a train wreck? And in one case, the editor of the Weekly Standard said this might almost have been a disqualifying performance.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you can't tell the difference between a real event and the Saturday Night Live routine about that event, when they pretty much are the same, you've got a problem. Inside the Perry camp, there is concern and not panic. They believe that he can right the ship. They believe that this effort, continued effort to characterize Mitt Romney as something that will not be appealing to the base, and offer Perry as the alternative, so differentiate between the two, is still the way to go. What I know happened was that these folks in the Perry camp were so arrogant in preparing for the campaign, and they really haven't had that much time. They've only been in the water for 6 weeks. That they were treating the debates as if they were like a debate in the Texas governor's race. He was tired. They didn't rest their candidate. They only did one mock debate. They didn't prepare him. They think they can fix this for the next two debates in October.
And the next one's coming up in New Hampshire, where yes. Mitt Romney, of course, is as strong as he is anyplace.
Yeah, and that's fine. I mean, Perry will attack him. I mean, that's the Perry motif here. The Perry campaign has two parts. If they were king of the world, one is to attack. This is a Perry Romney race, so you attack Romney by differentiating between yourself and Romney. Just make Romney the disqualified candidate in the minds of the evangelicals and the. And the Tea Party types, the evangelical sort of alliance there. And then the second thing is to offer up some element of hope, saying Obama's a bad guy and that I can make things better. As long as Perry is talking about vaccines and immigration, he's not talking about jobs and Obama, and he's losing. So their goal is basically to do that even in Mitt Romney's backyard of New Hampshire. I see no evidence that he wants to pull back. The only what I see is a newfound conviction. Get the guy a night's sleep so he doesn't sound like Alec Baldwin.
Wayne Slater, it's always good to have you on our program.
Great to be with you.
Scott Huffman is a professor of political science at Winthrop University in Rock Hill, South Carolina. Also directs the Winthrop Poll Initiative. Professor, good to have you on our show.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
How do you see this all breaking down in South Carolina, particularly, which has a very early primary?
Right. Well, it's probably getting even earlier after Florida's announcement, because you know the Republican Party is very likely to jump over that and go even earlier.
So hold it for a moment. I think our audience may not be aware of this. What's Florida decided to do?
Florida is going to defy the RNC and hold their primary earlier than South Carolina. And so this is almost assuredly going to cause South Carolina to leap over. In fact, the chair of the Republican Party in South Carolina is going to hold a press conference tomorrow where the date will – well, I'm sure is what's going to happen, is going to announce a new date.
Well, are we going to have then Florida jumping ahead of South Carolina again?
They can't after Saturday. The dates have to be locked in by the 1st.
Okay, and it's interesting that Florida would do that because, as I understand it, you mentioned the RNC, the Republican National Committee, you lose half your delegates if you start playing around with those dates.
And the guest passes to the convention.
Maybe even more important, you can't get the kid into the or the funder who comes with you. Well, go ahead and continue with the prospects in South Carolina. Let's assume that it'll be earlier than Florida.
Right. Florida could possibly go in late January. Well, you know, you have to sort of look at the three different groups that are Republicans and are talking about the nomination. And, you know, one group are the pundits, the party leaders, the opinion leaders. The second group are the activists, and these would be the people that, you know, are talk to bloggers at conferences. And then there's the rank and file, and they are not in lockstep. The elite and the pundits and the opinion leaders think much more strategically. They are the folks thinking, we want someone who can beat Obama. So they are likely to be the folks who take into their calculus who can appeal to the mainstream. They're the ones who are really excited about Christie because they are thinking beyond the primary. They are thinking about beating Obama. Now, the activists, the people that go to the conference, the people that show up at the party meetings, they are absolute true believers. They do not want somebody that they feel is not a purist in their beliefs. If they don't know much about somebody and they seem really conservative, as your guest pointed out, they'll like them at first until they really get to know them. But those are folks who are already convinced that Obama is so terrible he's not going to be reelected. So the person who needs to be reelected needs to be a purist. And then there's the rank and file. The two aspects of the rank and file, and this is true in South Carolina, that we need to keep into the backs of our minds are, number one, they are far more diverse than the activists who tend to be thought of as speaking for them. Number two, they're far less well-informed. They do not have as much information. So you have a lot of folks who support overwhelmingly a Lindsey Graham here in South Carolina, who is seen as, you know, not purist enough by some in the Republican Party, whereas, you know, the rest of the country sees Lindsey Graham as incredibly conservative. And then you have sort of the Jim DeMint, our other Republican senator, who is seen as much more of a purist. Well, they're all across the party. The rank and file folks in South Carolina do support Mitt Romney. And that's surprising for a couple of reasons. Number one, it's more than name recognition, because the Winthrop poll in April showed him among the front runners, but it was mostly name recognition in the teens. Our latest Winthrop poll showed Perry ahead, but Romney not that far behind. And the poll came out after a couple of those bad performances and after Michelle Bachmann, or a super PAC affiliated with Bachmann, had been beating up on Romney in the state of South Carolina. So, you know, his poll numbers were not that far ahead of Romney. So that tells you there's a diversity among the rank and file that's not as apparent among the activists and certainly not among the party leaders. And it also tells you that there are Republicans in South Carolina, an evangelical state, who are going to support a Mormon candidate. No one would have believed this last time around. I've told this story before. In 2007, I got a Christmas card from the Romney family, as did tens of thousands of South Carolinians, and it wished me a Merry Christmas, and it extolled the virtues of polygamy by quoting the Book of Mormon on that topic. Now, I think, as we all know, that was not from Mitt Romney. That was from people trying to smear him. It didn't take the way people thought. Evangelicals support Perry much more than they support Romney, but there's still a number that supports Romney. It's not as black and white, I think, as folks try and paint it. There's a lot more gray. It's the way it trends is evangelicals are definitely more likely to support Rick Perry, but they are not anathema to supporting Mitt Romney. And you have to remember the rank and file, because they're less well-informed, aren't always clued in to what the activists want them to be doing.
How certain are the rank and file in particular that Obama is going to lose?
A majority, I think it's somewhere around two-thirds of the rank and file Republicans and leaners in South Carolina believe that no matter who the Republican nominee is, that person will beat Obama. So they believe Obama is going to lose. That gives them, in their mind, the freedom not to just select somebody who they think can beat Obama, but they have the freedom in their minds to select somebody that they feel in tune with. In fact, as a question later on, the last Winthrop poll, we asked them, which comes closer to your beliefs? It's better to select a candidate who can beat Obama, or it's better to select a candidate who matches my ideological beliefs or matches my beliefs? And, 6 out of 10 said it's more important to match my beliefs than to just pick a candidate who beat Obama. And the reason for that is they already think Obama is going to lose.
Okay, so even though they're diverse then, they would lean toward a more conservative candidate, I would take.
Well, they're going to, because they're more conservative, they will lean towards a conservative candidate down here, but the belief that none will support Romney is also incorrect.
Okay. Scott Huffman, political science professor, Winthrop University, Rock Hill, South Carolina. Jonathan Tobin, quickly back to you. I'd put you in the first category, the pundits, opinion leaders, and elitists, or not elitists, but elite of the Republican Party. Is it dangerous for Republicans to think that Obama will lose whoever the Republicans nominate?
Well, of course it is. Barack Obama, certainly his chances have for re-election decreased over the last several months as the economy seemed to tank, and he has been shown to be somewhat weak leader in his dealings with Congress. Even his own base is very discouraged with how he has governed. That said, there are enormous advantages to incumbency for any president, no matter what the economy is doing. And Barack Obama has some special advantages, and I think Republicans have to understand. And this is not necessarily an argument for Mitt Romney, you know, vis-a-vis Rick Perry or somebody else, because, you know, the differences between Romney's polling against Obama and Perry's are not, you know, astronomical. I mean, if you're talking Michelle Bachmann, yes, there's a big difference there. But so he could certainly he's still going to be no matter what happens, he's going to be a formidable candidate. And anyone assumes that anybody who throws his hat out there can win is just kidding them.
Okay, that's all the time we have. We'll be doing a program soon on the Obama candidacy, and particularly how he's doing with African-American voters. Is he going to be able to turn them out as he did the first time around? Thanks to Jonathan Tobin of Commentary Magazine, Scott Huffman at Winthrop University, Bridget Harrison, our earlier guest from Montclair State University, and Wayne Slater with the Dallas Morning News. Good to have all of you on our program today. That was a rebroadcast of today's To the Point. Which Way LA was produced tonight by Christian Bordahl with Katie Cooper and Karen Radziner, our technical director, Phil Richards. You can email us or share your thoughts on our comment page at kcrw.com/whichwayla. Join the conversation on Which Way LA's Facebook page. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for Which Way LA on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.